Who here has ever had their heart broken? I don't mean just bruised. I'm not referring to the little nicks and scrapes you acquire in life. I mean flat out smashed. Like there are still tread marks left upon your ventricle or something. I mean, I'm talking about major damage being done to this seat of emotion. I think everyone here has got their own little story. Let me tell you one of mine. So I was in high school, which is how these stories almost always begin, right? High school, not my favorite period in life. Good stuff happened, and then also, it was a time of extremes. Let me put it that way. It was a sinusoidal curve in high school. Way up and way down. And so this is on one of the nadirs of my high school experience. And I was good friends with a girl named Megan Burnett. Megan was beautiful. Her twin sister was also beautiful, but I was interested in Megan, not Meredith. My best friend, Frazier, actually, was dating Meredith. And so Frazier and I, we were workout buddies. We always hang out together. You may not believe it now, but at the time, I was quite buff. And Frazier, you know, was probably the only guy in school buffer than me. And I'm not even joking. And I used to work out like 3 hours a day. So anyway, Frazier's dating Meredith. And of course, Meredith and Megan, twin sisters, they always hung out together. Frazier and I, best friends, we always hung out together. They're actually dating. So we would always go out on these things where they were on a date, and Megan and I were in this quasi-land that wasn't really defined. And, you know, high school dramas ensued, the sort of things I don't have time to go into here. But, you know, we moved along. We became better friends. A lot of funny stories. One day, we realized that this big dance was coming up. The junior formal, I think it was. And neither of us had a date. And so we made one of those sort of buddy deals, like, okay, look, I'll be your date if you'll be mine and no one else asks us, that sort of a thing. And she's like, that sounds great. You know, I was really, you know, I didn't want to be the only girl in the dorm without a date. You know, I went to a boarding school. I didn't want to be the only girl in the dorm without a date. Cool, we're set. And so we're going along, and I'm thinking, yes, you know, because I'm really starting to like this girl, Megan. I mean, she's smart, she's funny, she's really cute. And I am absolutely floored when out of nowhere, from my perspective, she comes up and says, Glenn, you won't believe what just happened. Rob just asked me out on a date. Great. Yeah, we're going to winter formal together. Yippee! I'm so happy for you guys. Pardon me, the wind's blowing a lot right now. I mean, it blindsided me. Now, what was the problem in that relationship? See, I had a different understanding of what was going on than she did. I thought that we were in a relationship. She thought that we were just friends. I took our sort of deal to go to this formal together as more of an actual invitation to the dance, to which, you know, even though we'd thrown that little clause, you know, if no one else asks us, ha ha ha, I was doing ha ha, she was doing, yeah, no one else asks us. And she felt like she was completely justified to accept this offer of a date from a guy that she thought was really cute and, you know, really good looking and wonderful and all these great things and taller and not losing his hair and whatever. I wasn't balding yet. And we had a conflict of perspectives. She thought friendship. I thought relationship. We were actually in a friend-relationship. And friend-relationships, in my experience, abound on the college campus. There's this thing that's happening with college students more and more where both guys and girls don't want to call a date a date. And you don't want to call a dating relationship a dating relationship. And so you sort of muddle through this sea of hazy ambiguity. Are we really seeing one another? Are we not? Sometimes one person thinks so, and then the other person thinks so. And if you're lucky, you both sort of, you know, coincide on that curve. And if you're not, well, it doesn't end well. In fact, the only way this relationship ends one of two ways, a friend relationship. It either steps up into a dating relationship, or it steps down, if you're very fortunate, into a friendship, or just down into a, I don't make eye contact with you when I walk across campus, and I'm changing my major so we don't take too many classes together anymore. And we've all seen that level of dynamic play out. And so what I want to do today is talk to you very frankly about the romantic relationships that, whether they're part of our lives or not, are part of our imaginations. They're part of our mental lives, and we hope, to a greater extent, a part of our real life. And sort of some biblical perspectives on that. I've got a couple of presuppositions I want to throw out first. And then I'm just going to walk you through a couple of concepts. And we're going to spend a lot of time on questions and answers today. That's how we're going to, you know, no come to the altar, no weeping at the front. Just be more, hey, what do you think about this, Glenn? Well, I'm glad you asked. I'll tell you and the entire internet just what I think. If you didn't know, we're recording our messages. We put them online. So if you like what I said tonight, you can tell one of your friends, go to Google Video, check it out. Or if you thought I was especially mockable tonight, you can make me like the next Jedi kid or whatever and, you know, send me around the internet and, you know, I'll be mocked mercilessly for years to come. Thank you. two wounds. I buried my heart tonight about Megan and now this too. First presupposition. There is no biblical method for mate selection. There is no, like, laid out, organized pattern that you follow that just says, here's how you pick your spouse. And this is important because if you've been raised in the church, you've probably heard one or more sermons at some point where someone has tried to defend the means they're advertising as the one true path. You know, right now, or actually in the last maybe 5-6 years, a big thing has been courtship. Like, yes, there's this way that, you know, the ancient cultures had that they would court one another. This is the right way to do it. If you date, you're going to hell, or at least you're going to be singed or something, and it won't be good. There's, you know, there's different periods where people, no, I think, you know, something like arranged marriages, and there's this notion of headship, and, you know, okay, look, all those things you can find biblical precedent for. In other words, you can find an example in the Bible, but you need to make a clear distinction in your mind. This is an important part of growing up as a Christian, learning how to interpret this book for yourself. And one part that you have to understand is learning to distinguish between when the Bible is being descriptive and when it is being prescriptive. And usually when it talks about things like how people got married, it's saying what happened, not endorsing it. Not saying this is the way it should be in all times, in all cultures. Things are different now. Things are very different now. And while you may choose to follow some sort of a courtship model or some other, you know, what most of your friends would consider to be an anachronistic way of going about the romance process, that's your choice. And you may have good, valid reasons for it, but it's not something you can enjoin on other people or even force upon the person you're hoping will be your partner in this romantic venture. So that's the first presupposition that I have. There's no one right way. The second presupposition that I have is that doesn't mean that we have no help whatsoever. There are principles in this book which can guide us in the romantic process. And they can be very, very specific and very, very helpful. We're going to launch on what I'm calling a loose study of the Song of Solomon. I say a loose study. In the past, when I've done a series on a book, for example, we just finished a series on Mark, I would sort of go through chunk by chunk and explain everything that was in there, or at least do every major story. That's not how I'm going to do this. This is going to be much more topical and thematic. And oftentimes, I'll just use one or two verses as a jumping-off point to talk about a broader biblical principle. So we're going to be looking at Song of Songs. Now, something I need to say about the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon. First is its name. Which is it? Well, it sort of depends. Like, the books in the Bible, this part isn't actually part of the Bible. The title on the book, that's just something that, like, we put on there to make it easy to find rather than saying, okay, if you have one with a white cover, turn to page 496. If yours is purple, it just makes it easier. We just label them. And the way that we label them is usually by the first few words. So, Song of Songs, depending on your translation, will either be called the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs. The concept of Song of Songs is very strange in our ears, like Song of Songs. What does that mean? Is that like, you know, a remix or something? No. The Hebrew way of intensifying phrases is to repeat them. The Lord of Lords. What does that mean? The highest Lord, the King of Kings, the greatest King. In the book of Genesis, when God says, you know, on the day you eat of this fruit, you will surely die. Well, the Hebrew for that is dying, you will die. You're really going to die. And so the Song of Songs means the greatest song of all. The ultimate song. And sometimes we call it Song of Solomon, Song of Songs. This book, you may have been taught, is primarily about God's love for us, or Christ in the church. Now, that is certainly an application of this book. That is something that you can find many key principles in here that will illuminate your relationship with God, because at the bottom level, human sexuality is about revealing something profound about God's nature to us. Relationships are about revealing God to us. So anything in the Bible that talks about relationships also teaches us about God incidentally. But this book is about sex. That's its main message. And that's what it's mostly about. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the principles that are in here, some stuff in Proverbs, a couple of things that Paul says in the epistles. for tonight, for our first little departure into these waters, we're going to put on two shoes, a left shoe and a right shoe to sort of balance us as we launch forth here. And so the first shoe that we're going to put on, the first little sneaker of holiness, is going to be from Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 7. This phrase appears several times in the book, but this is just one of the references for it. It says, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, which is a strange way to charge someone, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Cryptic yet intriguing. The other shoe I want to put on is from the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? This is an important theme in the Bible. This is not just one verse pulled out of context. Proverbs says, he who trusts himself is a fool. The heart, we have this incredible ability to engage in self-deception. And that is never more true than when we are blinded by love. Once the hormones start flowing, the neurons stop firing. And if you don't believe it, just ask yourself, do my friends go crazy when a certain someone walks into their life? If so, is it likely that I am the one person out of 6 billion who is unafflicted by this particular disease? Odds are no. You too have your brain shut off at certain critical junctures in life. And that's when it is most important to receive guidance from the ages and from your friends. And most importantly, from God and his word. So, what do you do when you find yourself in a friend relationship? How do these two shoes guide us? You find yourself in this quasi-land, this zone of, I like her, if you're a guy, and I think she likes me. We're not too sure on that. Or if you're a girl, you know, I think he's interested in me. I mean, he's never actually asked me out, but he compliments me a lot. He spends a lot of time visiting me. He sends me emails. He calls me. We go out to see movies together. He pays. We've never actually gone out to a restaurant. I mean, a dining hall, but I mean, that doesn't count. Is coffee a date? What's a date? I don't know. So we have this, once you have that sort of existential romantic anxiety set in, what do you do when you find yourself in there? Two words, get out. I don't mean get out of the relationship. I mean get out of the friend relationship zone. These two verses that are balancing us today. The first says, do not awaken love until it's the right time. Let love take its own course. Don't force it and don't throttle it, but allow it to flourish. The second verse says, the heart has an infinite capacity for self-deception. When you're in a friend relationship, you are generally very vulnerable to deceiving yourself about what's going on, and the important thing to gain is clarity. Now, I'm not advocating being an idiot. I know we're just sort of in line to register for our classes, but I thought now would be a good time to define our relationship. No. I mean, you find a right point, you find a right way, but you begin trying to figure out, is my interest reciprocated? Or, you know, the worst case scenario, you know, I think he may like me. And I'm not too comfortable with that. In particular, I'm not comfortable with that. That was funny to me. Or she may like me, I'm not too comfortable with that. You need to figure out where things are at. You can't let things linger in this zone. Think about your experience in life. The longer that you have let things like this linger, the deeper the wound at the end has been. That is a tend to rule. There are exceptions. Sometimes, by no fault of your own, things work out well when you totally botch the relational maneuvers. We've all seen it happen. But as a general rule, the longer you let things muddle on, the worse the end result, as a general rule. So seek clarity at the earliest opportunity. Now, clarity can mean one of two things. Either you're going to step up into sort of a formalized, yes, we understand that we're in some sort of an exclusive relationship. I have legitimate expectations of you not doing this same thing with other people, and you have reciprocal expectations of me. Or you're going to say, we're stepping back down into friendship. If you handle this right, that's where you'll step back down to. You won't go all the way, woo, into the deep end. But there are two things you have to guard against. There's this principle that I found very helpful in life. It's just six words that really summarize for me how we're to go about living. We worship God. We love people, and we use things. We worship God, we love people, and we use things. Whenever we mix these up, bad things result. Now, if you handle the transition up incorrectly, you're in a friend relationship, you kind of decide, oh, she does like me, he does like me, we're going to go to the next level, that's great. You can begin to worship the other person. You can become the joined at the hip couple that everybody hates. The hey, can you, we have this test coming up, can you be part of my study group? Oh, I don't know, I need to check. What, you don't have the class because now you're in a relationship? No, you don't need to check. Okay, quick question. Everyone in this room who is single, please raise your hand. Okay, everyone here is single, except me. Single means not married. Are you engaged? You are single. Are you dating? You are single. Are you not dating? You're even more single. But singleness means not being married. That's it. Now, for example, I was at a retreat once. My old campus pastor was a very funny guy when I was an undergrad. He had this thing at retreats. He'd always get up and say, now listen, we're here. You know, we're going to be sort of expressing our emotions to God. At a certain point in this whole retreat weekend, you may start to find not only your emotions flowing upwards, but they're flowing outwards. And you're looking around the room and your eyes meet. And you gravitate over and you're like, hey, let's go pray together. And you go find this beautiful spot by the lake. And you begin to pray. And you understand something. This retreat is a no groping zone. And I want to explain to you what I mean by groping. He kind of ran through his little, you know, checklist of this is how you know if you're groping or not. Because, yeah, we didn't know. And he said, this is the thing. The only way you're allowed to grope at this retreat is if you have a driver's license. And that's a marriage ring. And this one girl who's engaged raised her hand and she says, I have a driver's license. He says, no, you have a learner's permit. That means only if there is a licensed driver in the car with you. He was driving home a very important distinction. We often in our society allow, because we're so hesitant to call something a date now, in general, once we've got a date, we're like, woohoo, the sky's the limit. No. We'll talk more about this in future weeks, but dating does not mean that everything goes or anything goes. And you're still single. Act like a single. That means you do not become enmeshed in the other person's life. Yes, you see them. You go out with them. You have fun together. You spend recreational time. You go and, you know, bike or, you know, play squash or whatever it is you would do on a date. You don't allow them to displace your other friends, and you don't allow them to displace God in your life. If you do that, you are beginning to make an idol of that person. And the burden of idolatry is something that no mortal can bear successfully. You will be let down by your idol. Now, that's one way that we can go. We can go the worship the other person route if we handle the transition up unsuccessfully. Let's say we decide that, no, we're not going to go ahead with the relationship in a traditional dating sense. We're going to step down back into friendship. I see this more and more on the college campus. We begin to use the other person. Now, the traditional name for this is the hookup, right? The casual hookup. The, hey, friends with benefits. The idea that, hey, well, you know, no, we're not going to date, but, you know, you like me, I like you, I like me, you like you, we want to have fun together. I'm bored, there's nothing good on TV, or, you know, I've just got an A on my test or whatever. Let's just kiss for a while. That sounds like fun. Feels good, doesn't it? Let's do it. And there's no idea of a relationship there, of a romantic relationship, any sort of development there, but you're simply using the other person as a tool for your pleasure. That is not good. A, it's immoral. B, it's unwise. It is going to lead to heartache down the road because you were designed to fall in love. It is part of your nature to fall in love. How do you know who you will fall in love with? Very, very simple. Who do you spend the most time with? If you spend a lot of time with this person of the other gender, you will either begin to love them or begin to hate them. They will start to drive you up the wall, or you're just be like, oh, marry me. It's very predictable. Now, if you start hanging out a lot of time alone with the person of the other gender and you begin just rubbing all over one another, guess what? Sooner or later, one of you is going to have some very basic biological processes kick in, and the love cycle is going to be complete. And this thing will end in tears. Even though you both said going in, nah, this is just for fun. Will not work. I make that prediction very confidently. If you say otherwise, you're either lying or self-deceived. And you've seen it in your friend's life to know you need to trust me on this. This is the way it ends, with a walk of shame. So we can either, when we reach this point of realizing I'm in a friend relationship, I need to transition somehow. And I need to have a very difficult conversation that involves clarifying, either being honest with myself. Sometimes you don't need to talk. If you're just honest with yourself, or you get a trusted friend around and say, hey, do you think this guy likes me? No, he does not like you. Do not embarrass yourself by going and asking him. You know, that's a good first step, by the way. But, you know, or, you know, they're in a relationship already, and it's a good relationship, it's working out. Stay clear. Just say, you know what, I will just sacrifice this. I won't go for it. But if, you know, the venue's open, you think they like you, there's a good chance, you clarify. You're going to step up or you're going to step down, depending on sort of how things go. What you guys have together, you can either do it well, where you begin to enter a romantic relationship with the other person, or you do it poorly, where you begin to worship them, or you begin to use them, or allow yourself to be used by them, or allow yourself to be worshipped by them. That's really the core sort of roadmap I wanted to give you tonight. We put on these two shoes for a journey, these two verses, about not stirring up or awakening love before it's time, which is something college students are very eager to jumpstart, and then realizing our capacity for self-deception, and talking about the dangers of friend relationships. What I want to do now, rather than sort of building on my thoughts for the next, you know, 2 hours or whatever, just kidding, I don't actually preach that long, I'd like to just answer whatever questions you guys have to the best of my ability. Now, it may be that one of the things you ask is something I'm planning to cover in a future message. If so, I'll just let you know. Just, you know, put it on pause for now. But otherwise, my brain is open. How can I serve you? Yes?
What exactly is a courtship?
Okay. Courtship, well, it means a couple different things, depending on who's using the word. Some Christians, when they use that word, mean a very structured and well-defined process. In general, it means a set of romantic encounters leading to marriage. That's the goal. It's not an engagement. Engagement is part of the courtship process. But it understands rightly that dating is a process of mate selection. That's what it's about. I mean, whenever you are spending recreational time with a person of the opposite gender, one of the things you are doing is putting them through the mate selection filter. Maybe very lightly. I mean, it's first time you hung out with the person, you're having fun. You just think, maybe. After a while, very seriously, like, this thing could go somewhere. But that I guess would be for most people the difference between courtship and dating. Courtship is intentional about that. It's aware of that as the end result. But, yeah. I use the word dating to mean the same thing. John Schiavone.
So, a friend of mine from high school.
Yeah. Yeah.
For a long time. He believes that the best way to get to know a person from the opposite sex is actually to spend time with them in a group setting.
Yeah.
With other friends.
Yeah.
And I've always felt that that's good, but you also need some one-on-one time too, because people don't normally express a lot of things about themselves in a group setting. I was wondering, like, what are your thoughts on that in terms of getting to know somebody in terms of dating? Like, if that's one of the goals.
Okay. Well, first, let me ask a diagnostic question. One of my observations about college students, much more into group dating than one-on-one dating now. It's much more common to find yourself in a group of like 6 to 8 mixed gender people rather than in a one-on-one relationship with a person of the opposite gender. Is that generally true on this campus as well? I see some heads nodding, some people refusing to make contact with me. They're like, dear God, let it end. Rapture now, please. I would say that for some people, now, obviously, you want to do both long-term. I mean, you don't want to marry someone you've never been alone with. How weird would that be? At the same time, never you want to marry someone that you've only seen when they're around you. Because oftentimes, we put on our beautiful face for the person whom we love and we want to love us. And we're so much nicer to other people because there's only one person to be nice to, and we like them. It's important to learn what that person's like in different contexts. However, I would say that I suspect that there are many people who use herd dating as the coward's way out. Because for a guy, okay, now here's the dynamic. For a guy, the ask is a very high-risk proposition. For the girl, too. But generally, even in our very egalitarian society, it's incumbent upon the guy to do the asking at least 7, 8 out of 10 times. That's been my experience, at least, just looking around. Even feminists, most of them want the guy to ask for whatever reason. Mostly because they don't want to have to ask themselves. It's not that they think it's gender roles. It's just like selfishness. No, you suffer. You risk rejection, not me. And that's what it's about, right? Like, if it's just, hey, a bunch of us going to the movie together, oh, I'm busy, that's fine. You didn't reject me, you rejected the movie. hey, do you want to go see Fail to Launch with me? No. Well, okay, you may have rejected the movie, but odds are you just shot me down in flames. And so there's a safety mechanism in the group ask, right? Another is that it entails much less commitment. If you say yes, on the other side, right, you're not necessarily agreeing to go out with a person. I mean, you might be, and maybe he believes that or she believes that, but maybe not, and that's all good, because I know what I think this is, and I can just sort of, I can control the whole experience because it's a group setting, and I can define it in my own terms. That's college students really like ambiguity now, I've noticed, in the dating thing. I mean, they don't like it existentially, like it, you know, keeps them up at night, and you're like, I don't know! But in terms of their behavior, I mean, the reason that the term hookup is so popular, in part, is because it's so darn ambiguous. Does it mean you had sex? Does it mean you kissed? Something in between? Well, yes. It sort of means what it means to me. And if I'm a very, you know, sort of show-offy person, yeah, you know, I can use it to mean that I did more than I did. And if I'm a very modest person, I can kind of pretend I did less than I did. And so also with the date, you know, we like the ambiguity there because it gives us options, and we're chickens. So that'd be my answer. We're going to talk more about that actually specifically in another meeting, sort of some of the dynamics at work there. But that's in a nutshell. You had a hand, Rhea. Okay. You've actually got two, but one was displayed.
Yeah. Like, whenever they talk to, like, young people about dating and stuff,
yeah,
like, they always talk about the one, you know, yeah, like, there's that one person. Right. And, I mean, I just think, like, for a bunch of like, my friends, yeah, and myself, it's, like, it's so confusing and puts you, like, in bondage because, like, so I just wonder what you think about that, like, this idea of the one, and, like, there's only that one person. If you don't get that one person, you mess up for the rest of your life, and you're just kind of like, because that's how it was, like, you are doomed, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Well, who has heard something like that before? Or feared something like that before? Oh, dear God. Okay, very common. I do not believe that there is just one person for you. I don't think God's will works that way. I talked about this last quarter. I believe the messages are online. You can go to our website and look for understanding God's will or discerning God's will or something like that. Just Google around on there. You'll find it. But the bottom line of what I believe about God's will is that it is much more flexible than most Christians tend to believe. And God is much more concerned with other things than things that we freak out about, like who are we going to marry. God's much more concerned about with how you select your mate and how you are married than with who you marry. And if that confused you, we can talk more about it later. And I may even, I wasn't planning to do that, I may do a talk about the whole the one thing. It's like Neo. Are you the one? Yes, I can stop bullets and kisses. Yeah, I don't think there's just one. Yes?
So would you characterize dating as like shopping for shoes?
Yeah. Would I characterize dating as shopping for shoes? Very expensive shoes. No. What I would characterize dating as, I would say it's a mate selection process, for sure. And one of the things that's happening there is you're evaluating the other person. I don't mean that in a cold, analytical, you know, Spock-like way. What I mean is, like, the whole process is something that involves both our minds and our hearts and our wills. And we're being disingenuous if we're not upfront about the fact that one of the things that's at work here is, okay, something like 98% of all people wind up married. Now, margin of error in this group, maybe one or two of you won't be. Odds are, everyone here will wind up married at some point in your life. Now, who are you going to marry? Someone you dated, I assume. Oh, it's about that time. You! What? I mean, it's going to be someone you dated. And so that, by the way, is why it's very important as believers. Like, the Bible talks about Christians having this really important responsibility about not marrying people who don't share their deepest values. Good principle for everyone, but for Christians, one of the implications of that is don't marry someone who's not a believer. why would you date someone who you know you can never marry? Is that very loving to them? If you allow them to fall in love with you, or worse of all, you allow yourself to fall in love with them? Because love is not something you just generally, romantic love, you don't just turn it off or on. I don't know if you've experienced this yet or not, but you can't just like, I will not think about the person anymore and have it work. It takes time. That's hard stuff. And if you're deliberately putting yourself in a situation where you're going to inflame your emotions, where you're going to violate this idea of not stirring up or awakening love before it's time, you're going to force love because I'm bored. I'm insecure. I don't know how to have fun by myself. I don't know how to be fulfilled by myself. I need someone else to validate me or whatever your thing is. That road, very rocky, does not end well usually. So I see your hands. I see two other hands who have not asked questions yet, so I'll come back. I'll sweep. Leilani, then Key, then John. Okay.
Like,
I'll pick the one I like best. No.
I kind of still don't really completely understand the do not stir or awaken love.
Yeah.
Because
it's a theme we'll return to many times. Go on.
Okay. Like, talking about it or like bringing it to the point where it's like, let's make the decision.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of like stirring it up?
It's discerning whether or not it's the real thing or the right time rather than how shall I put it? Okay. So, dating is as much mental as it is physical, right? And I'm not talking about like making out and sex and stuff here. I'm just talking about the idea of like you being with somebody, like physically in the same location, like a coffee shop or something, or you know, walking in the park. You know, that's physicality of dating. But there's this whole mental world that, for most people, is the more significant part of doodling names on the paper, For girls, very frequently, what would our last name be like together? How does it sound? What would baby names be like? You have this whole mental thing that you sort of do. And guys, we do our own variant of that. Although it generally, by the way, guys, how many of you have thought about, like, I'd really like to, if I have a son, I'd like to name him this, or a daughter, I'd like to name her this. How many of you have really thought about that? Girls, how many of you? Guys, you're sunk. You've been outmaneuvered. They've been thinking about this since they were like 4. Unless your last name's really funky and it messes with their plans, by and large, you're going to have marginal influence over the naming of your child. So this mental game that we play, that's what I'm referring to when I talk about stirring up or awakening love before it's time. Because oftentimes, the mental dating relationships that we have bear little resemblance to the physical dating relationships that we have. Particularly when you're in friend relationship land. And you're allowing your imagination to run on these flights of fancy and, he's your knight in shining armor or she's your princess at the ball or whatever your little metaphor is. And you're setting yourself up to be hurt rather than actually taking the chance and allowing love to run its course, romance to blossom or not, by actually engaging in the full relationship. You sort of create a firewall between the relationship and your mind, and you allow your mind to do its own thing. And for guys, frequently manifest as lust and fantasizing. For girls, it more often a different sort of fantasizing, generally, about how sweet he would be. Right. You got two.
Oh, and then the other one is like, just sometimes I just get confused with like the word love. Like we should love all people, but then we always differentiate them by saying, "Oh, romantic love." But
yeah.
Like I still don't really fully understand like the biblical perspective on what romantic love is. And is it like just loving somebody more and like favoring them like more than everybody else? Like
great question. We'll come back to that in a future week. Okay. So that's to be continued. Dun 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 dun. Key.
Okay. So we can't always trust our emotions, and sometimes
clearly
in the Bible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, relationships are about emotions, so I don't know whether we can always find the solution in the Bible or whatever.
Relationships, I'm sorry, I cut you off, finish, sorry.
Where do you know when to trust your emotions, when to trust the Bible, when to trust,
Okay, great question. So how do we know when to trust our emotions and when they're leading us astray? Okay, there's always at least a chance that we're being led astray, but not just by our emotions, by our thoughts, right? Have you ever believed something that was false? I mean, like, totally rationally believed, like 2 + 2 = 9 or something crazy like that. Probably not that ludicrous, but since coming to Stanford, you've changed your beliefs about more than one or two things, I dare say. Maybe politically. maybe just sociologically, maybe just about the nature of something in math or science. But we all can be led astray by our logic and by our emotions. Now, our emotions in particular are prone to lead us astray because they are not bound by the principles of reason. And they are less subject to correction by reason. I would not say that relationships are about emotion. I would say that emotion is an important component of most relationships. And a key indicator that your emotions are leading you astray is you refuse to think about the subject at hand. You won't allow yourself to really meditate on it. Like you sort of have this blind spot that you build into yourself. You become aware. You notice patterns in your life. Like everybody here knows how to rationalize things really well, right? that's just like this skill you develop. And in fact, I've noticed, by the way, the smarter someone is, the better they are at rationalizing wrongdoing. Which is why, by the way, I don't think that universities in general produce more moral people. The people who designed the concentration camps were not idiots. Nor did they believe they were doing wrong. They had this heightened ability for rationalization because they were well-educated. The guys at Enron, what's the documentary about them called? The smartest guys in the room. Why? Because they were. In my experience, the smarter you are, the more you have to be careful that you're not rationalizing because it's so easy to do. And you want to, right? You want to have the satisfaction of doing something that you otherwise would not be allowed to do, and you're smart enough to figure out a way to explain it to yourself and to your slightly less intelligent or less pushy friends. Or to your parents or to the other girl or what, you know, whatever. No, baby, we weren't dating. We weren't kissing. No, this isn't a hickey. It's a bruise. She was attacked, and I jumped in and defended, and he karate chopped me right here before I, whoa! Why is it lip-shaped? He had a funny ring on, you know? Now, hopefully your rationalizations are worse than that, so that they don't work. But so one clue is that you notice you're doing the rationalization thing. Like, I don't know about you, I'm usually well aware when I'm rationalizing. Like, maybe not the very beginning, but quickly I become aware, these thoughts sound familiar. This is what I tell myself when I'm about to do something I really know I'm not supposed to do. That's a clue. Another clue is your friends. Your friends will not be feeling the same emotions as you. And that's why it's important, by the way. It's very important. If you're a guy, you have some close guy friends. If you're a girl, you have some close girl friends. So they can give you some real perspective on what's going on here. And you can just say, hey, you know what? I'm confused. Well, tell me what happened. Blah, 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 blah. And you take that as a sign of he's now rejecting you. That's interesting. If I did that, would you say I was rejecting you? No. Then why are you attributing it to him? Just because. And it comes out that's because, like, some jerk in high school broke up with her on Valentine's Day that way or something, you know? Which, by the way, if you're going to break up with somebody, Valentine's Day, bad day to do it. That's for free. Bad day. So those are some clues. The thing is, there's no real rule. If there was a rule, we would never be deceived by our emotions. We would just know, check, 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 my emotions are reliable. You just gotta, you grow in self-awareness. But those things are helpful to me. John.
You talked about earlier about dating or being in a relationship with people who are unbelievers.
Yeah.
And I don't know about anybody else, but I know I've definitely heard from a lot of people like who are in that situation, but it's a good way for me to be able to use that as leverage to convert her to the faith.
Right.
I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that argument.
A viler abomination has never crawled out of the pits of hell. I will talk more about this at some point probably, but let me give you sort of a quick thing right now. First, just from the angle of human decency, how manipulative is that? I mean, yes, I'm dating you for an ulterior motive. I mean, you're not good enough for me to actually date just in and of myself, but you know, since you're cute and you're going to hell, then I will do you the grace of allowing you to be a part of my life and the hopes that in your desperate desire to be around me, you will come to church enough that even though you don't want to hear it, the word of God will penetrate your earwax and, you know, well, that's just, no. The other thing is I generally don't believe people who say that. I think that I don't so much think they're lying to me as they're lying to themselves. You are simply unwilling to be obedient in this area because the emotions are coursing through you too strong right now. The hormones have the reins, and they're saying giddy up, not whoa. And it's amazing how far this track can go. Have you guys ever heard of, what were they called? The Children of God, I think it was, in Southern California, back in the 60s and 70s. Have you ever heard of frisky fishing, flirty fishing? Okay, so this is a group that began, you know, sort of a group like this. And they got more and more into this idea about missionary dating and reaching out to people. And, that's sort of the word for it in some circles, missionary dating. They said, you know what? Not only is it acceptable, that's going to become our primary outreach strategy. We're going to deliberately recruit the most handsome guys and girls that we can into our ministry and send them forth to evangelize for the Lord, to work the Lord's fields. And because we live, and so they began this process where they started drifting further and further away from any sort of boundedness until they got to the point where they were writing manuals on seduction for their members to use in witnessing. Like, and the goal was you wind up having intercourse with this person to lead them to the Lord for a donation. that would be used to further the church's work. Eventually, leaders were busted for running a prostitution ring. Cross my heart. I may talk more about them later. But now that's a slippery slope argument, which means that it's not intrinsically valid. I mean, it's a logical fallacy to argue that, you know, no, you will not actually wind up, you know, becoming a prostitute if you engage in dating non-believers. But what you're doing is not very wise. And in my experience, well, Leilani, come here. Walk over here. Not on the table. Don't worry. I'm not going to ask you to table answer anything. Just come over here. Stick your hand up. Okay. Is it going to be easier for me to pull Leilani up or for Leilani to pull me down?
Down.
Yeah. What's true in the natural is true in the spiritual. Thank you, Leilani. If you really believe that you're going to be able to exert that much influence over the other person's life, then you have to understand they will exert that much influence in yours. Because influence is almost always a two-way street in relationships like this. You become more like those you hang with. And it's true in romance as well. You will start to find some of the movies and jokes and whatever that they like, you know, funny and entertaining. You'll start to do that. They'll start to gravitate towards you. You change your mannerisms, your vocabulary. You will become more like them. They'll become more like you. Bad plan. So anyway, yeah. Ashley.
Along those lines, you mentioned that that when you tend to hang out with someone of the opposite sex for exclusively, like whether or not you're in a relationship, then you start to like them. Can you expound on that?
Now, this is thank you. So I said earlier, if you hang out with someone of the opposite gender, you're going to wind up liking them or really not. There'll be no doubt in your mind at some point whether you want to go out with them or not. They'll be well inside the circle or well outside the circle in your mind. Can I expound on that? Yes. First, I need to make clear this is a tend-to thing. The Dilbert guy, Scott Adams, the guy who writes the Dilbert comic strip, he likes to say book tie, but of course there are obvious exceptions. And he says that whenever he makes a perfectly obvious statement that someone, because he like writes an internet column and people just go nuts. He likes to say, you know, hey, it's raining, but not in Africa. Okay, I'm talking about Seattle. So, yes, I mean, there are always going to be times when, you know, guys and girls are just friends. But that's not the general rule, and you all know it. And part of wisdom is playing the odds. In fact, I would say that's the majority of wisdom. It's learning how things tend to turn out in life and making good choices in light of that. Now, I have a lot of friends who are decision analysts here at Stanford. So guess what I did for Valentine's Day? I sat down with a bunch of non-believers and talked to them about Jesus. And it's true. I bought Paula some little candies and stuff. But this is an ongoing... seriously, now you guys all think I'm horrible. Paula and I have this long-standing tradition. We don't go out on Valentine's Day because we don't have that much patience to wait in line for like 3 hours to sit at a restaurant. So we celebrate like the weekend after. Or the weekend before, sort of depending, but this weekend after. So I went, and I'm part of this religious discussion group where I get together with a couple of PhD students, mostly one or two master's candidates, and a couple of professors. A couple Hindus are there, some Muslims, agnostics, atheists, various stripes, philosophical Buddhists. Me and another evangelical believer. And we just talk about things. So I presented sort of the Christian perspective on the Trinity last night. But the thing about these guys, and they're maybe 75% guys, is their tend to be clustered in this one field of decision analysis, a subset of the Management Science and Engineering Department, MS&E here at Stanford. So if you're in that department, I'm probably like talking with your TAs or your professors right now. And they make this distinction as decision analysts between making good choices and having good outcomes. Those are two distinct things, right? And it should just be intuitively obvious to you. Sometimes you make a dumb choice and a good thing happens. Sometimes you make a wise choice and a bad thing happens. What determines the wiseness of a choice is not the way it turned out for you or for your parents or for someone you know or for someone you saw, for something that happened in a movie. It's what probably would have happened. And so if you're going to be spending a lot of exclusive time with a person of the opposite gender, what's probably going to happen? One of you will start to develop feelings for the other. And I just stand with thousands of years of human history and billions of pages of writing by the sages backing me up on that. So that's the 10-2. Sometimes it doesn't happen, but way the majority of the time. Yeah.
Is there a remedy to that?
Yes. Not hanging out with them. Okay, no, ask your question. Meditate on these things. Read Song of Songs, not with that person. We'll read alternating verses. I'll take the voice of the beloved. You take the voice of the lover. Nothing bad will happen as a result of this. It's about the Bible. It can never lead to sin. Yeah, whatever. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah. We're going to begin talking about that in future weeks. This is sort of this week is sort of the setup of the problem. A couple of solutions, but mostly sort of like, it's like this, to be continued. I'm going to build on and sort of say, so we don't want to live in relationship land, we don't want to live in idolatry land, and we don't want to live in just utility land. So where do we want to arrive? What's our goal? What does a healthy romantic relationship look like? How can we know if we're in one, and how can we attain one if we're not? I'll try to give some very practical guidance in that next week, with the caveat that while I'll be sharing biblical principles, I will not be sharing the one true path, because that path does not exist in this particular arena. Yes, Rhea?
Okay, in terms of like when you get to know someone, like,
yeah.
You're probably interested in getting married or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you know how they say...
Hopefully you don't start there. That freaks people out. Guys, they run. Hey, I'm getting to know you. I want you to know you're on the marriage list, my friend. Great. I'll be in Canada. Okay.
One of my friends,
yeah.
They've been dating this guy for like, well, again, they've been dating for like a year or so. And so, like, you know, it's like in the Christian circle, because you hear, oh, you have to wait until a year before you can get married, or you have to wait until, you know, it's going to wait. Or like this one guy, I mean, he said that he just told God he wants to know his wife when he sees her. Mm-hmm. And like in a matter of less than 6 months, they were married. And so you have the success stories on both sides, and you also have the failures.
People win lottery too. Doesn't mean much.
Yeah. So it's like, is there really like a stipulated time, or is it just some things that you need to see? You know?
That's a great question. I will say Christian people, for whatever reason, like making rules. The Bible... So contrary to people's opinion, the Bible does not contain a lot of rules. God's not a big fan of rules in general. Now, he's got some. You may have heard of 10 of them. But for instance, when God was able to set the world his way to his own satisfaction, Garden of Eden, how many rules were there? One rule. Now, because we wouldn't obey that rule, God had to like start adding clauses. You're like, you know, okay, by that I mean, boom, boom, and you know, and so it's exploded from there. But the bottom line is, there's just one rule. Someone came to Jesus, Jesus, there's all these rules in the Bible, what should I do? Love God, love your neighbor. Everything else flows out of that. God's not a big fan of rules, but Christians love rules because rules are safe. Jesus is dangerous. Faith is dangerous. Wisdom is dangerous. Developing wisdom. You know how you develop wisdom? Failing. You do something that doesn't work and you say, I'm not going to try that again. I would say, my experience, we tend to learn most from our own successes and from other people's failures. That's my own little thing. I didn't make it up, but I found it to be very true in my life. But so I would say there is no one right time, but if you meet someone and you get married the next day, I have questions for you. And if you're still dating after 5 years, I have questions for you. And maybe we could talk more about that at another time, but it's 9:29. We end at 9:30. I know some of you guys have commitments. So if you would just join me in a quick word of prayer, and then do not forget on your way out, pick up one of Rhea's tickets. All right. Father, we thank you for this wonderful, confusing gift of relationships and sex and marriage and this whole convoluted set of concepts. They really are confusing, but they are also the most exhilarating thing in life sometimes. Help us to walk relationally in a way that honors you. Give us insight from your word, from our friends, from different sources that will help us to live lives that are holy and pleasing to you. God, help us not focus on rules and regulations, but on simply being yielded to your Spirit and understanding what true love looks like. We pray that you empower us in our relationships. In Jesus' name. And everyone said, amen. Amen.